Wings are back with a rockin' new album, Back to the Egg. It's really cooking. A dozen big ones on Back to the Egg, the brand new Wings album. Wings, Back to the Egg, a timeless rock and roll flight through 12 superbly produced new songs on an album that really is perfection. Wings' brilliant new album, Back to the Egg, out now on record and cassette.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. We are a Paul McCartney talk show mainly dealing with the solo career of the one and only Paul McCartney. This is episode 140, where we're going to be talking about the Back to the Egg album. I'm one of your two co-hosts, Tom Hunyadi. There he goes. Andy's got it in his hand right there. And our mystery guest has it right there as well. And as you may know me from my other show, Talk More Talk, a solo Beatles video cast. And as always, I'm joined by my partner in crime, a backwards traveler, Andy Nichols. Andy, what's going on, my friend?
Good evening, sir. Welcome back.
Yes, welcome back indeed. Back into the swing of things. Staying busy. I know you're starting back up again. We're getting busy. And, like I told you people before, I went back to my catering job that I had a few years back. So we've been crazy busy. I mean, as cities cramming all these toilets, trying to, get back that money that they lost over the last
recoup.
Year.
Sure. Busy times.
Busy. Absolutely. So, we're getting like 4 or 5 days in a row of tours, and we get, one day off, and then it's back, more tours. So they're definitely kicking back in. So, but as you can see, we have a guest with us today who I've been really excited to have. I've been trying to figure out a way to get him on over the last year, and he's finally here. We figured it out. Back to the A, and Steve here, he's a music journalist. He's done liner notes for plenty of CDs and box sets, and he's a podcaster, and he's a DJ. He's going to tell us all about that in a little bit. But Steve, welcome to the show, and how you doing, my friend?
I am doing very well. It is an honor to be here, and I appreciate being asked to talk about this album, and I look forward to our conversation.
Very cool. So, Steve, let's just, we're going to skip the news. Really not much news to talk about or anything. I think it's been a little quiet in the Maca universe the last couple weeks. I know a couple things are being shipped, and I'll show those when we or I or Andy gets the stuff. Let's talk about, what you do. You got your own YouTube channel, right, Steven Schnee? And then you also show some of your shows that you have out there in the web. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, my channel, I have a whole bunch of different, series. I have CD. Well, I'm known as the CD junkie because that's all I collect is CDs. And I have shows where I focus on a certain band, and those will be 8 minutes to 15 minutes long, whatever. Plus I have interview shows where I interview artists. And then I also do a show with Matthew Street called the Matt and Steve Show. So all these shows appear on my channel. I don't want to say regularly, but as often as I can do them. And then I do a show live on Tuesday nights where I play my radio show called This is Ski Lodge. And that focuses on sort of sunshine pop from the late 60s up through soft pop from the early 70s. And sort of a good time feeling type show. And I get more and more people showing up live. Each episode's about an hour and a half long. Well, I don't save them, so you have to be there live, but you can hear the shows on Mixcloud.
Yeah, no, they're a lot of fun. I really enjoy hanging out and listening to, because I, you know, as music fans, we all want to discover new music, and you know, thanks to you, especially your '80s show that you do you still do that, or do you not? Is that completely done now?
No, I still do it, but I do a This Is Pop, which is like a power pop and power pop adjacent show, and I do a '80s show. And both of those shows are less frequent because the Ski Lodge shows are the ones that really attract the listeners. And I only have a certain amount of time, and I want to keep putting out stuff that, that people are going to come back for and listen to, week after week. So I do Ski Lodge once a week, and the other shows I try to fit in once a month or once every 2 months.
Gotcha. And then, you know, you're also this, you know, big power pop guy, like we know Matthew Street is. I mean, you guys have interviewed, you know, musicians in that genre. Talk about that genre for a second, because it seems like it's kind of like an underrated genre. I mean, it's not a lot. It doesn't get that much attention, in my opinion. Do you think?
No, it doesn't. But that's because the big thing is that power pop is something different to everybody. Andy might think power pop is different than you might think. To me, power pop is that sort of skinny tie, jangly guitar, harmony, 3 minute great. Basically, what, in my opinion, a great example of a power pop album would be the Hard Day's Night album by the Beatles. Now, people don't consider that power pop, but I think that that's really the formula. So, you know, the 2-3 minute songs, great harmonies, hooks that go round and round in your head. You know, there could be some ballads in there and stuff, but a lot of people will think that maybe a melodic grunge band might be power pop, which is not the case. Power pop doesn't necessarily have to be limited to just 2 guitar bass drum. It could have strings, it could have piano, but okay, it's one of those things where you know it when you hear it.
And what, give us like a few of you, the big power pop bands that people should know in that genre.
Like one of the biggest power pop bands would be The Knack, but My Sharona to me is not necessarily power pop. Good Girls Don't is perfect power pop. Okay. If you think about now The Romantics, What I Like About You, or When I Look in Your Eyes, those are kind of garagey power pop.
What about a song about like by the Raspberries, Go All the Way?
Yeah, that's 100% power pop. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Badfinger, No Matter What. Badfinger, Baby Blue, Badfinger, Day After Day. You know, bands that play this kind of music, also, you know, let's say a band like Squeeze, who are not power pop, but they're, you know, their earlier stuff are like RG Bargy and, you know, those albums, they're really close to what power pop is. Some people may know some of the Squeeze songs and go, well, gee, I like that melodic hook-filled pop. But like I said, usually all power pop, and I don't mean this negatively, is derivative of the Beatles. Basically, the Beatles laid the foundation for it. I think, actually, it goes all the way back to Buddy Holly. And then you take Buddy Holly and you throw him in a room with Everly Brothers and you get the Beatles. And then you build upon that, you know. But there's so many great power. The Rubinus combined the great crunchy Beatles pop with the bubblegum pop of the Archies. And Shoes is another great band. The Last, their first couple albums, and there's so many great bands. Usually they start with the word "the." 2020 is an exception. They're a great power pop band. Paul Collins Beat, another great power pop band. And gotcha. No, not Phil Collins from Genesis. I'm talking about Paul Collins.
Yeah, you know, I mean, when you were playing, you know, power pop, you know, I kind of get the gist. I mean, because, you know, there are some, you know, 90s musicians out there that maybe have that power pop aspect of them, but maybe not necessarily power pop. But, I mean, it was basically, you would say, like, probably, what, 70s to mid-80s where the power pop probably had its best run.
That was really sort of when it really started bubbling and boiling up. You know, it had always been there, but it really came to the surface then. And there's still great power pop bands out now, like the Legal Matters, and just great hook-filled power pop bands. But again, since power pop is such a specific genre and it doesn't sell, like if I walked into any record store today and said, "Do you have a power pop section?" they're going to go, "A what?"
Right. Or even like it's like sunshine pop. I mean, could you even classify sunshine pop today? How do you do that? Do they even know what it is?
Exactly. And that's the problem. Is so a lot of people are going to say, "What's power pop?" But if you walk in there and you say, "Do you have any cool guitar indie bands?" So, "Oh yeah, we got this whole section here of guitar indie." Power pop is a very specific genre, but it's not really. I mean, if you really look, Jellyfish is one of the biggest power pop bands ever. They don't sound like 2020, but they come from that same mold that the Beatles set in the 60s.
Gotcha. Now, also around that time too, late 70s, we come in with the new wave, because, and we're talking about these genres because it kind of, you know, it kind of works in with the back to the egg type of
the arrival of the Sex Pistols, 76, right. 77, really.
Yeah. Now the Sex Pistols came in and, you know, even though they were edgy and punk, if you really listen to them now, they're not. I mean, the Sex Pistols are like, well, you know, you listen to other bands that came after and you're like, holy crud. The Sex Pistols were like mellow compared to some of these bands, but
right.
The Pistols came in and they knocked down what was going on. The whole pompous, pretentious, singer-songwriter and prog rock.
Basically.
I'm not saying that stuff is bad, because, you know, I love that stuff just as much as anybody else, but they came and they knocked it down and said, "Hey, we're taking it right back to rock and roll's foundation." And then bands started building from there. But a lot of bands, they either went to the edgy, hard-edged punk side. Other bands like The Clash were somewhere in between, where they were edgy but they were melodic. They knew how to write songs. The Undertones, Buzzcocks, these bands knew how to write songs. They knew that the song was the most important thing. And so that's sort of where new wave came from. You know, then you'd get the herky jerky post-punk of like Gang of Four and Wire and people like that, who weren't playing. Post-punk is more like experimental punk. But some of the bands, they went in that melodic direction. And so, like I said, when you think back to those periods, The Jam, I mean, there were bands like Yachts, who were just one of the greatest bands from that period. And they were sort of caught somewhere between new wave and power pop. So they were hard to classify. The Records were coming, the group The Records. Like I said, The Undertones, Buzzcocks, Brahms Tchaikovsky, The Motors. These bands were coming out and they were focusing on the 3-minute song. Because people had forgotten what a 3-minute song was. I remember once, in between my freshman and sophomore year in high school, partaking in the Mary Jane with a friend in his house, and he put on Yes, Tales of Topographic Oceans, and as soon as that was done, I put on Squeeze Argy Bargy, and then he started going, "Dude, this is weird. These songs are short." And it's like, yeah, because you're talking, you know, you could fit 5 or 6 songs aside on a Squeeze album, and you could fit half a song on a Yes
Ritual
album.
Yeah, side 4, Ritual, done.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
So, but it was the energy, really, that you know, because a lot of these bands were basically pub rock bands. They came, you know, Nick Lowe, Elvis Costello, The Damned, all these people were coming from this sort of pub rock. The Stranglers. Stranglers were like 10 years older than all the other punks. And they were all coming from this great pub rock movement that was happening in the UK. Then it became punk rock, it became new wave and power pop. And 79 was really right before synth pop really took over. I mean, there were bands already, you know, that were doing it. Right. But
so if you, you so know. If you can kind of set the scene for 1979 for when Back to the Egg comes out. I mean, as you talk about, you've got the punk and you got this new, you know, power pop and the new wave. You know, was there any room out there for these older musicians out there? Or?
We see that's really the main thing here is there was always room, and I'm not you know a Paul McCartney's sycophant, but there's always room for Paul McCartney somewhere, right. You know, and McCartney, and I'm sure you guys have touched on this, never made, you know, through the 70s, never made the same album twice,
right.
Every album was completely different from what came before and what came after. So when, you know, I think that London Town came out at a time when punk and energy and this stuff was really catching on. You know, you were more likely going to see people queuing up outside the marquee to see Buzzcocks or somebody like that. And that's what the papers there were going to focus on. They weren't going to focus on McCartney filling up Wembley, you know, or, well, actually, he wasn't touring after for London Town, but you know what I mean. I mean, if he had played there, that would have been the show to see for 95% of the people. But the papers were focusing on this new, burgeoning, exciting movement. Punk had sort of started dying out commercially. Right. Because it was being taken over by the melodic stuff, you know, the you know, the more hook filled,
more radio friendly stuff. Yeah,
not quite. Yes, more radio friendly. When we think about it, when we hear it now, definitely more radio friendly. But a lot of these bands still weren't getting on the radio, but they were more comforting or accessible.
Accessible.
Yeah. Yeah. To people outside of punk, the people who were too scared to go deal with safety pins and spiked hair. They didn't want to get beat up at a show. They wanted to go to a show where they could just, you know, pump their fist in the air and just go, this is awesome. This is great music. And that's kind of the whole power pop and new wave thing was really happening. So you're seeing all these great bands filling these great clubs all over England, LA, New York. They were about a year behind, maybe 6 months behind. They were still doing the punk thing, but the power pop thing was growing. So you were getting albums by 2020. You were getting albums by Paul Collins. These were the albums to get because it was song oriented, and people were really getting into the fact that, hey, we're going back to guitars. We're going back to 2-3 minute songs. And it was just a really super exciting time for the indie bands, for, you know, just the local bands that never broke out of their cities, for the international or the internationally successful bands. It was a very, very, very exciting time for music because you didn't know where it was going to go.
Right.
And that was just wonderful.
Very cool. So, you know, Back to the Egg comes out June of 79. We get this something completely different in March from Paul, Goodnight Tonight, you know, which was a big, you know, top 10 hit from Paul. And then you get Back to the Egg, completely different feel, you know, yes. than from that hit. But the album itself, like I said, it only goes to number 8 in the US, which at that point in time is as we're showing in the charts, right, Andy? I think London Town going to number 2, right?
2.
Yeah. Two, yeah, and
again, we're showing since Wildlife, really.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So, but like you said, Steve, I mean, all of these up and coming, you know, younger bands that are emerging. You can tell that the youth is starting to embrace these acts. Mm-hmm. So, but like you said, there is a spot for McCartney. But yeah, go ahead, Andy.
So to say, like, so you said Tom went to 8, right? Which by any artist's measures, that's a great showing. Went to number 8, but by that time, after the success of Wings,
right,
that was a real, real failure for them.
Right, exactly.
You know,
and then go ahead.
The interesting thing about number 8, okay, if you think about number 8, think about how many copies it took to get to number 8. That's probably about 50 times, maybe even 100 times the amount that it takes to get to number 1 today. So he's still selling a lot of records.
Right.
Yes.
You know, but yeah, it's just not getting, you know, where it should have been, actually.
And, right. you know, that incredible run of 5 number one albums, including a live album. So that's a tough act to follow.
Triple live album.
That's right.
Yeah,
on top of that. So, you know, it certainly was, you know, the end of a decade and really kind of going number eight. You got to look at him going, okay, well, I guess we're really kind of, this is the end now because, you know, we've bombed out here. But when you look, it's hard to say bombed out and you hear number eight. It's still a good showing.
Right.
And especially when you go back to that record and you listen, still today, that album still retains that energy. You know, sometimes you can go back to any record. I'm not talking about McCartney, but you can go back to an album from 1979 and say, oh, that's a little flat now. I remember it having more energy back when it came out, but not Back to the Egg. Back to the Egg still retains the same power and the same punch that it had when it first came out. And you get this wonderful new energy in that album that now I love London Town. It's my I have to admit Back to the Egg is my favorite Paul McCartney album. But there was such a renewed energy. Could it have been Steve Holly, you know, the new member Steve Holly on drums, Lawrence Juber on guitar? Could it have been that? Could it have been that Paul McCartney was sitting there and saying, wow, I really dig Bram Tchaikovsky. I really dig the Undertones and you know, whoever else I've mentioned. I want to go back to that. I want to go back to my roots. I think this Back the Egg is a great successor to Band on the Run.
Right.
Because Band on the Run was filled with that energy.
Yeah. Very good point, Sinead. The energy factor, both of these are very close. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I should specify that it was eight here in the States, but did go to number six in the UK.
UK,
and I think you kind of saw a switch starting with this album, with McCartney kind of now starting to do a little bit better on the charts in the UK than he was here in the US. Mm-hmm. I mean, but disco was still king come 79. You know, even though we were getting all of this, you know, the new wave and the power pop, you know, and the punk mm-hmm. were still going strong here, disco was still king, you know. So now you're you know, fans are, you know, you're picking and choosing what genre of music you still want to buy, you know, whether it's, you mm-hmm. know, vinyl or cassette or whatnot.
I think that McCartney was really just at a creative peak. Because look at Goodnight Tonight. Now, people say that that's his stab at disco. If you go back and listen to it, it's more of a, it's got more of a Latin feel than anything
disco,
else.
Than a disco feel, yes.
Right. Yeah. And plus, McCartney does this thing in that song that he only does like a couple bars, that, you know, that little weird little vocal thing, right? It's one of the catchiest things in the song, and McCartney doesn't overplay it. He just does it this little segment in the song. And then it's backed with a song that I consider one of McCartney's finest and completely different from the A-side and completely different from Back to the Egg.
The album, but Back to the Egg, yeah.
Yeah, but
and
still
maybe that's why he didn't put him on the album, because thematically they just did not jive with the rocking concept of the album.
Yeah. Now, Daytime, Nighttime Suffering, one of his best songs ever, in my opinion. If it had been mixed different, it probably would have fit on that album. But it's such an amazing song that I just always ask myself, how is it that wasn't an A-side and wasn't a number one single? But he was so creative at the time, had so much great material that he was okay leaving that as a B-side.
Right.
You know, but go ahead.
No, but I was just saying, you know, with the album Back to the Egg, you know, you mentioned Back to the Roots type of thing, mm-hmm. You know, which, you know, Paul had that same idea 10 years prior, you know, with the Get Back thing. And then, you know, for my research, Linda came up with the idea with, you know, Back to the Egg for the title. And it was kind of like the theme of the album a little bit.
Concept,
mm-hmm. right, exactly. So mm-hmm. what do? You bring in Chris Thomas, co-producer. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, work with the Sex Pistols, work with the Beatles, you know, so he's got
Pretenders,
Procol Harum.
I know.
and he produced Badfinger's Wish You Were Here, which is my favorite album of all time.
Oh, wow. Okay. So bringing in like a Chris Thomas, you know, who has that experience working with Sex Pistols, Pretenders, mm-hmm. you know, punk, new wave stuff at that point in time, you know, you got to get a sense that, okay, he's going to try this, you know, this kind of genre. Now, Chris Thomas is kind of like that safety net, you know, in a way.
Mm-hmm. Plus, he knows
he's got that.
And he knows him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that working with Chris Thomas, I think, was a great idea, because what Chris Thomas was able to do, and in fact, it's very similar. Similar ideas to when he worked with the on the Chaos and Creation album with the guy who produced
Goodrich.
Nigel Radiohead. Goodrich.
Yep.
Yeah. Thing is with Chris Thomas. Chris Thomas came in and said, "Okay, here, Paul, you've given us, you know, 36 tracks or enough ideas for 36 tracks. Let's strip them down to 12." Whereas with Nigel Goodrich, he probably, you know, the sound of that album is very big at times. So I think that he allowed Paul to do what he wanted, where Chris Thomas helped Paul cut the fat, so to speak. Not that at that time that there was a lot of fat in McCartney's material, but he helped keep it rooted and filled with an energy that equaled anybody else at that time.
Right, because when you got to the album, you know, the first, you know, first nine songs, they're all upbeat songs, you know, they're mm-hmm, filled with mm-hmm. energy on mm-hmm. these songs. I mean, even a song like Again and Again and Again, which is not mm-hmm. you know, the biggest rocker on it, it still has
right.
a really kick-ass guitar solo on there. It's still upbeat,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And well, then, Arrow Through Me is a little more jazzy.
Yeah, I mean, of the first nine songs, Arrow Through Me is probably, you know, the only one that's really more on the, like a, would you consider like a more open new wave with the all the synth work on that song?
What, on Arrow Through Me?
Yeah.
I think, we see, I have a theory that there's a time-traveling Paul. Okay. That Paul put out, Paul should have switched Arrow Through Me and put that on London Town, and then put on, like, I've had enough.
I'm back to the egg. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that, somehow the time-traveling Paul McCartney got those two songs mixed up and like, I can't go back and change it now.
Right.
But, see, Arrow Through Me still has the energy because he has that rawness in his voice mm-hmm. that kind of really, yeah. you know, when you think about other songs, you know, it's not that George Harrison 1974 tour rawness. It's a pure...
The Rod Stewart rawness.
No, it's a pure... I'm letting my guard down. I don't need to have the smooth yesterday voice. I need to give the song what it needs.
A little more, yeah.
Yeah.
And he's got that, a bunch of these tracks. I mean, even, you know, a song like Winter Rose is still raspy, raw kind of voice. Getting back to the album, okay, it was recorded what do we got here, June of 78 to February of 79,
a couple different locations.
You got, you know, in Campbelltown, the Spirit of Ranchian Studio, you got the Limp Castle in Kent, you got EMI and Studios
Replica,
which was the first time mm-hmm. because, you know, Paul's not a patient person, you know EMI was booked, and then so what does he do? He goes downstairs in the basement of his
Soho, EL,
right? Soho. Yeah, yep. and turns it into a studio.
Yeah. It only uses it once and then dismantles
right.
it.
Right.
Yeah. Don't forget that.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
But, you know, we were fortunate enough to talk to Chris Thomas, the Mother Show Talk More Talk, during that White Elm Symposium, and he mentioned a lot about, you know, the length of the sessions here, because this is, I mean, that's a long time. You know, you're mm-hmm. looking mm-hmm. June to February, you're looking at what, 8-9 months there? And he was talking about how unsatisfied he was on his slide of tracks. He was talking, he would mention how Bowie would come in and heard the bass line and he complimented on Paul on it, and then he ended up changing it.
For well, Bowie wanted the broadcast to be a single. So I mean, come on.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, so, and then another thing I found out too was doing research was the song Cage was originally on there over Baby's Request. I didn't know that, Andy.
You're not, I did.
So, which Cage would have made that even more interesting.
Cage, mm-hmm. Cage should have been on this album. It really should have been, my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and it came within a couple months later. Then it got a Back to the Egg TV special, which was pretty much just all videos of a bunch of the songs. Funny enough, the UK didn't get that special until 81 after Wings had pretty much broken up.
I remember watching that, and it was on a it wasn't on major channels. It was like local channels. So in Orange County, where I was living, it was like on Channel 9 or Channel 13. But I also remember shortly after. Okay, the album came out in June, right? Yeah, well, in September is Labor Day, and during Labor Day is the Jerry Lewis Telethon, and that year, 1979, Paul McCartney did not show up, but he sent the videos of Spin It On and Getting Closer. So during the Jerry Lewis Telethon, they played the brand new Paul McCartney videos, or brand new for Jerry Lewis Telethon.
For that, yeah,
right. Yeah, and they were the same clips that are in that TV special. You know, they didn't film anything special just for that
special
show.
For it.
They were
the videos, right?
Yeah, so I just remember being excited because you know.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, so you said you know you got London Town. Did you get London Town when it came out?
The day it came out.
That came out. So cool. then the following year, Back to the Egg. What were your thoughts when you first put? Because would you get it on record or cassette back then?
Record.
Great. Okay.
Well, one thing that I remember clearly, you know, before we talk about Back to the Egg, London Town. I remember, Licorice Pizza was a record store that, a chain in California, and they would have signs made by Capitol, you know, that were probably 12 by 24 or maybe 24 by 36, whatever, in the windows. New Paul McCartney album, and then they would handwrite the date in or whatever. So they would have the album cover. They'd be advertising it, you know, a week, two, 4 weeks before the album came out. So you'd get really, really excited. Back the Egg, I don't remember them doing that. And, of course, I think Back the Egg was his first album on Columbia.
Columbia.
Yeah, so they were obviously going to do something different. But when I heard the album, it blew my mind, because at that point, I'd already, since February 1978, I was buying any record by any power pop, new wave, punk band that I could find. But I was still a Beatle fan. Been a Beatle fan since, I was 5 months old when they did the Ed Sullivan show. So of course I don't remember it, but so I grew up with the Beatles, loving the Beatles, and you know, disliking this, loving that, you know, all that stuff. But when Back the Egg came out, I was just floored, because wow, this is Paul McCartney, this Paul McCartney that we all love, doing this energetic new wave, some may call it power pop, even like the. It was just awesome to get like two different two-song melodies or medleys on there. And, you know, sure, you sit there and you go like, well, those are just incomplete songs he probably threw together. I don't care what they are. Just each of those two songs on each of those medleys are fantastic. And then just to get this blast of great energy and great songwriting. You know, that's the thing. The hooks right up front. You know, it's not like here, let's get creative with the production. No, it's like, let's put the songs here, and then we'll put everything else behind them. And that's really the way that Paul McCartney works best, I think, is when the melodies are just right up front.
Right up front.
You mentioned the songwriting where, you know, he must have been on a creative peak at this point in time, because, you know, London Town, what'd you get? You got five co-writes with Denny. Here, you didn't get any. So that team, or that co-writing team, it was pretty much non-existent after London Town, and plus with the success of Mullen McIntyre. So here you are. I mean, all the tracks except for one are McCartney, you know, credited.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, obviously, you know, these songs are fresh. I mean, a couple of them came from years prior, but most of these are pretty much, you know, right in that time.
Yeah, and all of them are just kind of different from each other. So, like, if you listen to, like, the opening guitar on To You, or if you're listening to this, you know, it's not like, hey, let's get this energy and let's just play these, you know, a certain way. Every song is arranged different, mm-hmm. you know. So, hey, let's start this one out with the guitar, or let's start this one out with, you know, this, or just this. Everybody come in with a big strum and then get, you know, go right into getting closer. Right. And just, it was such a fascinating and exciting album. And it's still, when I listen to it today, I still get that excitement.
Well, you bring up a good point about the different sounding. I mean, with all the rockers on here, they all sound completely mm-hmm. different, you know, and you can go to like maybe like a Guns N' Roses or Metallica, you know, and a lot of those rockers, they sound the same, you know, especially their earlier stuff, you know, with here, you know, I totally agree with you on that. I mean, each rocker sounds completely different. I think that's one of the great things about this album as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, different guitar sounds.
Yeah.
And you know, it's, and one thing that if you listen on the surface, the one thing that is kind of missing is it doesn't have more Linda on the surface.
Hmm.
But when you listen to any Wings album, she's such an integral part of that
Absolutely.
Harmony.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. We sing her praises all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, and she's so important to that Wings sound. And, you know, even Paul McCartney's subsequent solo career up until her passing had that
element
certain
in
sound.
It.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's sorely missing once she passed away, because it was, you know, Paul and Linda's voices, she didn't have the greatest voice, but she had the greatest voice for Paul McCartney and Wings. Yeah. She was,
agreed.
You know, you get the Paul, you know, the perfect Paul, you get the Denny, and right in
Denny
between.
Denny and Linda, it's a perfect, yeah, the harmonization of those three voices really contributed to it. And that's, you know, and she worked to get to that. You know, she wasn't, to your point, she wasn't a great singer, but she evolved and he really worked her and they created a great sound.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And
she was perfect for what she did.
Yeah. Andy, when do you remember discovering the album?
Back to the Egg. Second generation Beatle fan, so really just kind of going through and learning the discography. Really, didn't really know anything about it other than it was just the next album to get. You know, it's
right.
like okay, you got your list, you got your books. Okay, well,
right.
and again, this is, I grew up in the late early eight, you know, mid '80s, early '90s. Mm-hmm. So you're just looking. Okay, there's an album called Back to the Egg. I've got to find it. Don't know anything about it, but I'll give it a try. And that's, you know, of course, was my initial, because maybe I might have seen the video for Getting Closer, maybe on VH1, maybe, but my exposure to it was rather limited other than just finding, getting it, you know?
Right, because first, Wings Greatest comes out prior to Back to the Egg. You know, the singles don't do great. They're top 40, but they don't do great. You know, we're getting closer, and Arrow Through Me, they do fine, but not, they're not great. And then plus, there's nothing on, you know, all the best from Back to the Egg.
No, so it's very kind of like a hidden album. Right. Like, well, what's really on this record? Because nothing really, again, publicized. To your point, there's no big hits on it on compilations.
Right.
So, you know, I remember being pleasantly pleased. I mean, it's a record I still revisit quite often. I like London Town better, as much as Schnee here, but it's one that I revisit quite a bit, and it still retains the freshness from the minute I heard it 25 years ago, even till today.
There's lots of interesting things going on Back to the Egg. Like, you know, when you're talking about Arrow Through Me, when those horns come in, you know, it's kind of, you know, everything else, you know, might have, you know, a certain sound to it, but when those horns come in, they're right there just jumping out at you. And, you know, they almost scare you when they come in because, you know, you're not expecting it because, you know, it's mostly that keyboard and stuff. But, you know, then you've got just like, I mean, Rockestra theme with all these great people on it. You've got So Glad to See You Here, which surprisingly, you know, there's that you know, at the very beginning of the album, two or three songs in, you get We're Open Tonight.
Oh, you get the link. Yeah.
And then So Glad to See You Here, the whole band starts playing that. And, you know, it's almost like a return to those, to that musical part, but it's such a big different thing, and it's much more powerful, and it inspires you to say, I'm going to go back and listen to this again.
Right. Yeah, you know, no, I agree. I was getting the you know, all the McCartney records at this in the mid 90s or even early 90s. I mean, I had like Greatest Hits and stuff like that, but I didn't have like actual albums until pretty much into the 90s. And then I remember towards the end of the 90s, I went to go visit uncle, who was inspirational for my Beatle fandom. And, you know, we played London Town and Back to the Egg. And I remember liking London Town a lot more lyrically, but then I was just so, you know, surprised by Back to the Egg. And like you said, the energy of that album is just phenomenal. But let's get to the songs. We can just, you know, run through our thoughts on them, because this album opens really interestingly, you know, with Reception, you know, and then just going through, you know, radio stations and, you know, and finding something that you like on the radio. I mean, what did you think about the opening song? Or I don't know if you want to call it a song or an instrumental.
I thought it was great because it set the standard. It kind of made you say, like, what are you going to get? What's coming up? You don't know, because when you're switching around the radio back in those old days, you know, this before satellite, a lot of people, you know, we all had to do that when we were younger. So you're switching around and you're trying to find something that attracts you and makes you want to stop at that station, and then bingo, getting closer.
Johnson. Right out of the gate. Oh, it's tremendous. Yeah. It definitely sets the stage for what you're listening to. Is this going to be a concept album again? You know, it's throughout the whole piece. I mean, unlike really all of his, none of his albums at this point, it opened up with something quite as esoteric as that, right? Switching radios and hearing all this stuff in and out. And you don't really know that until you hear the other pieces on the album later, like The Broadcast and other things, you know, that you hear in that little 2-minute opening opening of the Reception, which is very interesting, I would think, for that. But yeah, I was always like, okay, don't know what this is going to be. And then boom, right into a gold standard, in my opinion, getting closer.
Yeah, and I just you get to exactly. I really enjoy Reception. I've been enjoying it more and more, especially this whole weekend. I've been playing this album nonstop, you know, and I really dig the idea. And if this was, you know, planned to be a concept, you know, album, it did start off, I think, properly with the way it started, and then bam, right into you know, Getting Closer, which, you know, for me is, like Andy said, good point. You know, the gold standard, you know, for rockers, because you just, you know. Early in those 70s, in mid-70s, we were getting good rockers here. But then, you know, with London Town, it kind of like almost stopped with. But, I mean, I don't really consider I've Had Enough or Name and Dress to be like those hard-pounding rockers like he would do, like with Junior's Farm. And even with, you know, Getting Close, perfect, I think, rocker. And I think Lawrence Juber was a great addition, because I think, you know, his electric guitar playing, or just his brilliance and his knowledge of the guitar, I think was really great for this album, you know.
And I think the album has so many great songs on it, but there's no song that could have sat in that place after Reception other than Getting Closer. I think
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think through the rest of the album, maybe you could switch a couple songs around, maybe, but I think it's fine, you know, the way it is. But yeah, Getting Closer is fantastic. And I almost look at it as, remember the 1-2 punch that he gave you on Venus and Mars, Venus Mars Rock Show, then he comes up with a ballad right after that, which is one of his greatest songs, Love and Song. But he does it again with We're Open Tonight.
It's the same kind of feel, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, so Getting Closer, it was the first single from the album here in the U.S. O Siam, Sir was opened in the U.K., but went 20 here. Here in the U.S., so not bad. I mean, an okay showing. However, you know, you would maybe think maybe Arrow Through Me may have been the better the first leadoff single. I don't know. We can talk about that once we get to that song. Mm-hmm. We're open tonight. Yeah, definitely had that feel. Again, as a kind of like a concept, you know, we're getting closer, and then, you know, we're opening tonight. Maybe
in fact, you know, I think that's what the album was going to be rumored to be called for a while.
Right,
it was going to be
tonight.
It's going to be called that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah, and it definitely had that love and song feel.
And also, I'm Caring.
Yeah.
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 Absolutely. Yeah. Good point.
You know, so he basically hits you hard, or at least, you know, either, you know, sound wise or emotionally at the beginning, and then gives you this really soft song, and then doesn't really get that soft for the rest of the album. You know, it's kind of like, okay, here we are, we can rock it, we can lay back and chill, but you know what, we're just going to end up, you know, rocking it for the rest of the album. It doesn't offer anything quite as mellow as We're Open Tonight.
So, and then to kind of continue with the theme, then here, This Is It, and then it goes, bang, you know, and get some crunchy guitars to where you think, okay, we're at the show, you know, here's the announcer, this is it, bands on the stage, they start playing. You know. Andy, your thoughts on Spin It On?
I think this is all the songs that kind of capture that kind of punk period. I think this is the one track on the album, other than maybe To You, where you can really hear where he was derivative and trying to be influenced by some of that music coming of that time with this track.
Yeah, Spin It On, I think, was like, out of all the songs on the album, as much as I love it, I think it's the weakest track on the album. But it is the most new wave punk influence. In my opinion, the most obvious new wave punk
influence. Yeah, it's clear that's derivative of the punk influence is all over that track.
Yeah, but I think that was the B-side of
It was the B-side of Getting Closer.
Yeah.
And, you know, cool guitar solo from Juber on that one. Obviously, you know, there was a video filmed for the special as well as Getting Closer. Then these two songs were also performed for the 79 tour.
That's right.
Know, obviously, they liked them enough to present them to the crowd and for the tour.
And actually, fun fact, if you watch, there's a little clip of him warming up with the band that he had in 87 on the Wogan show. And the band goes into a little riff of Spin It On before they actually go into the next song. Which is, check that out on YouTube if you haven't seen that.
Yeah.
Yes, good find. Then we get to song five, which we get to the one and only Denny Lane composition here again and again and again, which I think from time to time kind of gets a little pissed on from time to time. Doesn't maybe get some respect. Yeah, I know that maybe it deserves, but I really enjoy this one. You know, what about you, Schnee?
Yeah, I like it. I think it's whimsical Lane, not quite as whimsical as maybe, you know, one of the songs he did from Deliver Your Children or
right.
London
but Town. I think it's in that vein, and I think it totally fits, because again, it has an energy, but a completely different energy, you know. Would Daytime Nighttime Suffering have fit better on the album? I don't think so. I think that this, I think it's one of those songs that kind of needs to be there, because I think that when you get an album that just pow 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 all the way through, it kind of becomes a little overwhelming. So sometimes you need a pow pow drop a little bit, pow pow drop a little bit, and I think Again and Again and Again is one of those songs that allows you to sit back and listen to the melody,
take a deep breath and get ready for the next.
I mean, Lane does a great job vocally on it. I just think it drags a little bit too long for me, and it takes changes the mood of the album a little bit too much.
Part of that could be the fact that this was originally two songs. Again and Again and Again, and then the other title, Little Woman. So, and then it was Paul that suggested, okay, let's
merge them.
Because, you know, it's worked so many times. You know,
as he does later on the album with two songs,
and it's going to work again in a few songs later.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
twice.
Yeah, again, so a video film for this one. Again, it was performed during the 79 tour.
They did it live then, too, yeah?
Yeah, they gave it live to get, you know, Denny another vocal in there. So, again, I think it's a fine song. It's a nice addition to the album. And then we get to, like, another really strong rocker, Old Siam, Sir Andy.
This is a great one. This is a cornerstone track for me for this record. One of the strongest on the entire thing. Great little keyboard intro there, which I think is Linda.
Yeah, Linda's idea that's for the kind of the Indian theme to
that. Yep, which is tremendous. I remember, too, we're talking about Paul's voice on this record. Right. He was still smoking pretty heavily back then. So that probably lent itself to the raspiness of the voice as well.
Possibly.
You know, he was still a heavy smoker then. So I've always thought about that, too. But Old Siam, and you can raspy. You can hear it on this song. Man, but it's just a great rocker throughout.
Right. You know, I get a little nervous because, you know, I give Let Me Roll It to You a hard time because it's just built around that same riff over throughout the whole damn song. And here, this is kind of built around the same riff as well, but it changes tempo and goes into a different direction.
Something else, right.
Something else, you know, a couple times during the song, which, you know, I think exactly, which I really appreciate rather than, you know, again, that might be the key to having a professional like Juber in there to kind of, you know, change it up a little bit, the guitar wizard that he is. And Schnee, what are your thoughts on Old Siam, sir? Sorry.
I thought that it was an extremely brave and ultimately bad choice for a single.
The UK.
I absolutely love the song. First time I heard it back in 1979, so I guess June 1979, I thought, oh, he's taking that same idea that he did with Morse Moose and the Grey Goose. He's coming up with this great little riff and building a song upon it. Like, I don't think he sat there with his, you know, with an acoustic guitar and like, oh, I am sorry, and then write it down, you know, like he does in the Waterfalls video. I think that Old Siam, Sir was probably created as a jam, probably sat there at a piano and then Denny goes, oh, okay, let me play that, and then it just built from there. That sounds like a song that built itself, and
it's right, it was kind of like a band it was a band feel, it was a band
collaboration.
Collaboration, thank you, that was the word. Yes, thank you.
So, yeah, and again, it got played live, and they did a really great. You know, he really supported a lot of, you know, a lot of the tracks on that 79 tour. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're from this good, healthy amount. We're from this album, and Old Siam, Sir. That's a brave song to tackle vocally, you know.
Yeah, and it's but like I was saying earlier, it's a brave and ultimately unsuccessful single.
Mm.
I think that Old Siam, Sir should not have been a single because of the fact that it was so different.
So different.
That it was going to throw people off. Because I'm thinking more of a commercial thing. Like, every song on this album could have been a great single, but, you know, if you want to attract somebody to the album, you know, in the UK, it should have been Getting Closer. Even To You might have been something to float to radio, maybe not release as a single, but release to radio.
Let me ask you about that. Let's kind of work on that a little bit on this whole commerciality of this. When you're listening to an album, do you kind of like listen to songs that will be commercial in a sense, even though it might be, it might never be a single? But are you listening for that kind of thing, Schnee, when you're listening to something new?
Here is the crazy, stupid thing that I've been doing ever since I was a kid. Is, you know, I was big on making mixtapes and then mix CDRs, right? So whenever I listen to an album, I hear the songs. Like, would this be something that one of my friends would like, or all of my friends would like, that I could put on a mixtape? Sort of like going through and kind of choosing singles. And what is the most commercially the word I like to use is the most immediate song, you know, the one that hits you on that first listen. You don't want to put out a single that's going to take seven listens for you to catch on, because if if the DJ starts playing it after three listens, you're not going to hear it enough to sort of immerse yourself in that song. So yeah, I do listen to songs. Now I don't like them. I don't judge them. Oh, is this, you know, this song's better because it sounds more commercial? No, but whenever I listen, I've been in the business long enough to be able to like hear a song like, you know, Haircut 100. The minute I heard Love Plus One, I knew that was going to be a hit. Now I don't pick hits. I'm not whatever, but I knew stuff like that would be a hit. And there are songs that, you know, Old Siam Sir would not have been something that I would have immediately chose as a single.
Gotcha.
In fact, Back the Egg to me works better as an album than a collection of singles.
Singles. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I see where you're coming from. Yeah.
You can't sell AM radio on an album. You know, they should have gone FM on this, which I think that was kind of a problem. I think that they were aiming it for AM radio because that's people who were buying Paul McCartney. That's people who bought Silly Love Songs. That's people who bought With a Little Luck. They should have actually taken this to album radio and pushed it to them because it was it's just an incredibly powerful record. Not necessarily top 40. Not necessarily My Love and Listen to What the Man Said, you know.
Right. Gotcha. So then from that, then we go through what's the song which I think is probably the most commercial on the album. Maybe would have been a better opening single than Getting Closer, and that's Arrow Through Me. Let's hear your thoughts on that, Shanee.
I think it's an incredibly amazing track. Again, I don't think it should have been a single. But then like I said, this album works as a whole. And Getting Closer was an amazing single. But, you know, at the same time, though, it was just because Arrow Through Me was so different than the rest of the songs. So when you present Arrow Through Me, people are going to go, oh, my God, he's recorded London Town 2. I can't wait to hear the album. And I think that's because it doesn't represent the album. It represents Paul as an amazing singer-songwriter and Wings as a great band.
Right. But it also had kind of, you know, to continue the success with a little luck, it still has that kind of feel that With a Little Luck had.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you don't want to put out two singles that sound the same.
Very similar. You know,
very similar heavy, sounding. Right.
Heavy stuff.
Back to back, mm-hmm. but it worked the first time, you know. Obviously, it could have worked the second time, too, if that was the opening single.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I get that, but like I said, it didn't represent the album. And I think that the first single always needs to represent the album.
What the album is. Gotcha. Good point.
Kind of what I think a lot of us call the gateway track. You know, a lot of people will say, you know, hey, what's the best song on the album? No, I mean, the thing is, the song that you want to focus on is the gateway track. If you like that track 9 times out of 10, you know, that's kind of the track that best represents the album. Arrow Through Me was not that, even though it's an amazing song. Yesterday is not a gateway track for the Help album.
No.
But it's an amazing song. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. Andy, your thoughts on Arrow Through Me?
It's from the minute I heard the song, it was my favorite on the album. Hands down, start to finish. A little bit of a Steely Dan-esque feel on this track, too, a little bit, you know? Mm-hmm. Which I've just loved. I loved his vocal on it. I like that it was included on the Pure McCartney compilation a couple of years ago because somebody obviously thought it was worthy of a reassessment. Very slick song. To Sneeze point, not in style with the rest of the album at all, but it works. I know it was a top 40 single.
It was 29.
I don't think I agree. It should not have been a single because it wouldn't have worked. It works better as an album piece. And I agree with Steve.
Okay. You know, an interesting thing is you're saying it fell in the top 40, right? Name one casual McCartney fan that knows that song.
Yeah, no, and
you know, which is kind of weird. You know, and that shocks me that it fell within the top 40 because if I mention that song to anybody apart from kind of like the people who are a little deeper into McCartney, if I mention that song, they're going to go, "Oh, no, I have no idea what you're talking about." But then they might say that about Getting Closer too.
Right. And that just begs the question to ask then, okay, so were the casual McCartney fans falling off because maybe they didn't really care for London Town and they didn't give Back to the Egg a try? Were the hardcore fans starting to fall off again, you know, again too? I mean, you know, were they, you know, going in paths of different musicians as well? I mean, it's just kind of interesting to, you know, why didn't this album, you know, resonate with the casual or and the hardcore fans, you know?
I think it was because of the time. Because like I said at the beginning, look at 1979. Such an exciting time for music. Like the old guard was kind of falling into the background. Right. So even Steely Dan or... you know, Doobie Brothers or all these people were being cast aside because the young guard was climbing at the charts. Disco was already on the way out. And I think that people, it was just bad timing. I think that people were overlooking the album because they were looking for the next best thing. And they didn't realize that the next best thing was actually Back to the Egg.
Right.
Right.
Moving on, probably one of my least favorites on.
Tom doesn't like this one.
Yeah, I'm not the biggest fan of Rockestra Theme. You know, I find the riff boring. You know, I find that you got all these great musicians on the planet, you know, the best on the planet, and then this is what they do. But you know, it was a single in France, I think it was the Grammy winner in 1980 for best rock instrumental performance. So you got to give it you credit for that. You know, I also performed the concert for the people of Kampuchea. But Snee, Steve, you like this one, right?
I love it. I think it's it just a great hook. Again, going back to energy, you can feel that everybody's digging it. Now, do I think it's overdone? Do I think there's too many musicians on it? I would love to hear a Wings version of it. Without right. all well, the extra things going on. Well, I'm not saying it would be as good or as powerful.
Right. They kind of did do something like that, but just overlapping, you know, the guitar parts on top of the guitar parts and stuff like that. So they did have kind of a feeling of what they were going into, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
I love it. But go ahead. I love it.
Yeah. Andy?
I love it.
Absolutely. Again, cornerstone track of the album, Rockestra Theme, the hook, everything about it. Big bombastic piece. I think it's great. The lyrics, I don't care about the lyrics. Having any dinner, I don't care. I think it's great. I mean, what a way to kick off side two, right? You flip the album over, boom, right out of the gate. Awesome.
Yeah, good point. I mean, it is a really good way to grab your attention again once you flip the album and brings you in. Yeah,
especially because Arrow Through Me kind of just guided you down to this whole feeling of like, wow, that was a great, great side one. Then you turn it over and it kickstarts it.
Right.
Yeah. All over again.
Right. And then to continue with that, you know, with that energy, then you get another pretty good, rocker to you, which for me, I find underrated. You don't really hear a lot of people talking about this one when they talk about Back to the Egg. But again, you get that raspy vocal from Paul that I just really, really appreciate on this one. Andy?
On To You? Yeah,
For You.
Now, you like this one. I'm not as keen. I'm not as keen on this To You. This is one that I probably wouldn't have played as much. It's never done that much for me. I appreciate where it goes, and it keeps the consistency of the record together with a spin it on type feel. But I've never enjoyed this one quite as much as some of the heavier ones like Old Siam Sir or Spin It On.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Steve?
I think that To You is a great track. I think that it's probably pretty close to what the demo would have sounded like, if not just the demo with stuff added to it, because it has that rawness, but it also has a freshness to it. Sure, he's sort of aping 50s, 60s rock or whatever, but he's having fun with it. And that really comes through. You know, the overall theme of this record is these guys, whether it's Paul, whether it's Chris Thomas, whether it's the band, they're having fun making this record.
Right.
That's what it sounds like.
You're right. And then you really get the good Denny and Linda backing vocals with, you know, you know when Paul's singing to you and they're, you know, they're adding their backing vocals to, you know, It Can Happen to You. I really, you know, dig that aspect of the song as well. But then, you know, the next two songs, 10 and 11, tracks 10 and 11, you really, you know, just it's changes kind of the whole
a little bit of a left turn
turn right there. And then, you know, and it's great when he does these, you know, these puts these songs together, but you don't really think that he would do it twice in a row, you know?
But it works,
you know, but it works. And I really dig it. You know, the first one up is After the Ball, Million Miles. You know, medley. You know, Paul didn't think these songs were strong enough on their own, so obviously he puts them together. Steve, what are your thoughts?
They're absolutely incredible. I think what Paul's trying to do is saying, hey, is this going to be my Abbey Road side two? And then he puts these two songs together, and everyone's getting all excited, like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. But then he changes it again. I think these songs are great. I'm glad he didn't throw them away.
Yes.
You know, you know, you think of a song like Waterspout. Why did he throw that away?
Exactly. Yeah.
Daytime, Nighttime Suffering. Why did he throw that as a B-side? But he did not throw these away. And they're emotional, you know, because of the raspiness in his voice and the production and the melodies and the arrangements. They're actually just, within these two songs, four great, beautiful songs.
And exactly.
Incredible.
I'm kind of surprised he just didn't put all four of them together
for one big
medley. Yeah, and I think you know, I think they could have easily found a way to do that, but do you do that for four, you know, kind of more ballady, you know, type songs, you know what I mean?
Interesting, Tom, to see how he would have sequenced those four.
Right.
Would he have changed the order of them all as one piece, you know, like a Red Rose Speedway, you know, medley for the winner?
I love when this happens. You know, because like I said, we're getting songs that he may have just thrown away.
Right.
And you know, are these songs going to change the world? Probably not, but they changed mine. You know, they added to mine, you know.
I mean, Million Miles might be the lesser of the two, but After the Ball, I mean, my God, the vocals on After the Ball is ridiculous. Yeah.
Right. No. I agree. Yeah. So then track 11, the second medley, you know, in a row here, which is one of my favorite songs on the album. I really love Winter Rose and Love, especially going into Love Awake. It's just so beautiful. I think the way they transfer into Love Awake is excellent. You know, and then you just hear the two, you hear the raspiness in Winter Rose, and then you hear the smoothness of his voice in Love Awake.
Love Awake.
You know, and it's perfect in my opinion. Obviously, you know, the video was filmed for the TV show. But Steve, what are your thoughts on this one?
It's beautiful. Like I said, these, you know, I love the fact that they are close together. I mean, it might have made more sense to put one on side one and one on side two, but to have the songs together, it's, you know, it's a quartet of these great, beautiful songs that, I mean, the harmonies on, you know, Love Awake but there's such, again, even though the songs sound sad or you know, mid-tempo, mournful, whatever you want to call it, mournful, they're still, that you can still feel that joy in creating this music. That's what I really love about this record, is you can feel this record. More so, you know, he's put out great records, but this one is just so much something.
It's a real, it changes, you know, you've listened to 10 tracks, and most of the tracks are full of energy, and right out of the gate, you hear all this crazy rock and music, and now you hear four ballads, really, in two songs, and you're like, okay, this is a total left turn here, but it's good. It's a good turn.
And then another complete turn with track 12, The Broadcast.
Okay, now maybe turn. Maybe I was wrong when I said that Spin It On was my least favorite track of the album.
But the broadcast is completely, I mean, just out of left field. I mean, it's yeah. kind of.
Well, here's where
I dig it. Go ahead.
I dig it, Tom. I dig it too. And here's why it works. Okay, because you hear that those strings that you hear at the beginning of the reception. So that's coming back mm-hmm. to that whole. It's lending itself mm-hmm. to the concept album, okay?
Right.
Because you're mm-hmm. listening to the beginning of reception. You're hearing the dials change, and you hear those strings coming in, and you're like, "Now you hear it again. Now it's right. yeah. now it's connected. Now it's connected." And you're okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, I know where they're going with this now. I get it. And that's what this yeah. is. And it's. And I think it's beautiful. I do.
And I like the fact that it's actually the owner of the castle that's reading passages from a couple books. I think that's just really cool. You know, the Sport of Kings and the Little Man that yes. he's reading from. I just yes. think it's just so unique in a way that, you know, you don't expect something like this to work. Maybe it shouldn't work. But
you don't know what the hell it means. You know, we've got a chance. Right. We're going to take it. We may win, right. win or lose. Or what the hell yeah. are they talking about? I don't know, but it sounds good.
I think, in my personal opinion, this is really McCartney showing his experimental side. And then when you look back on what has come before, right. what has come since reception to the broadcast, it kind of... It does sort of draw that sort of experimental thing. Those other songs in between those are not experimental, but what he's done with the album is very experimental.
Because
right. he's gone from rock to soft. He's put the ballads in there. I mean, this could feasibly be, you know, a collection of hits, and mm-hmm. maybe these are a collection of a particular journey in McCartney's life, or a journey he wants the listener to take
right.
from that right. reception, and then all of a sudden it starts making sense by the broadcast. Right. Still very experimental. Maybe it doesn't work for some. Maybe people look too deep into it, but yeah. like me, maybe but maybe there's something in there, you know.
Yeah. I think there is. I think there absolutely yeah. is. And you're just thinking about it, just going through all these tracks in my head now. When this comes out again in the box set, and people right. that don't know this stuff and it gets reevaluated, their minds are going to get blown when this comes out yeah. again.
Right.
It really is.
I think so. I think so. Yeah, I do think over the last 10 years, well, 11, 12 years or whatever it's been since I've been on Facebook, and then, you know, being part of McCartney chat, you know, with pages, you see mm-hmm. people slowly starting to, their thoughts on Back to the Egg are starting to become more favorable over the last 10, 15 years than maybe it was, you know, in the first maybe 20 years of its existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I've been. This is the one that I've been. Got a piggy bank and keep putting quarters in and just waiting for this thing to come out as a box set. Right. This is something that I find that there are many people out there who love this album, but I think that when. When the naysayers or the people that are not in love with this record, when they hear it again, when they have a chance to reevaluate it, it's really going to blow people's mind. I mean, I'm hoping when they watch this that they go out and they pull the album off the shelves, LP, CD, you know, however you want to listen to it, and give the album a listen. You know, give it a fresh listen. Wipe
yeah.
All your preconceptions
clean
away.
Slate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Clean, yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Then we get back into another big rocker after, you know, the two previous tracks. I mean, obviously, this is the continuation of the Rockestra group, you know, people. But then it goes again. You have a nice little coda to where it goes back to revisiting, you know, We're Open Tonight, which again, you know, kind of, you know, brings us back to the theme of you know, of the album. But again, I mean, it's just, I think I find this one a lot more interesting than the rock. Theme. I kind of like this one more. I like Paul's vocals on this one. I like the, you know, the back. It's got some good backing vocals as well. But I really dig that We're Open Tonight kind of at the end.
That,
like, you know, with the, you know, he's done in the past yeah. with like 1985, and he, you know, brings back the Band in the Run.
Yeah,
you know, track. Yeah. You know what I mean? So he's done that before.
I love that.
And he's done it. He's very good at that. That's going back to Abbey Road. That's going back to Pepper. Right. That's going back to all those mm-hmm. things that he thematically tie these albums. up in some kind of a concept way. And he does it with the last two. He does it with the broadcast, and he does it here with the We're Open Tonight coda, which, and I think it's a great show. I think it's, I almost would have liked it if it was actually the last track on the album.
Yes, and not yeah, exactly. Request.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That, I was that, would have, that, up.
Yeah. That would have been a great closer.
Yeah, but I think so too. I think the great thing about this, and I mentioned it earlier, you know, that We're Open Tonight reprise, what it does is, you know, even if it's your first time listening, you know, you're remembering, okay, even though it's chunkier, and excuse me, even though it's chunkier, doesn't it have almost that reggae type you know, part to it?
Yeah.
And it's got this chunkier, bigger sound. It makes you go, I got to go back and hear this again, because with the broadcast and this, it's all coming together, and it plays out. And Baby's Request is almost the ending credits.
The ending credits, point there, Shay. like he does with Broad Street with Goodnight Princess, has that same kind of vibe to it.
Right.
The movie's over, lights are on. Okay, gotta go. See you later. You know.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's the exit music, if you
will. It is. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what a, you know, and here we go. He brings back a, you know, the so-called granny, you know, song, if you will. I don't know how you feel about the granny songs and
I love
McCartney's
it.
Oh, channel.
Give us more granny. Go.
Yeah. I love that stuff.
Thank you, Schnee.
I love Juber's guitar playing on this. It's great. You know, vocally, I think it's a great vocal performance from Paul as well. You know, I just think the band is really kicking it on this album. On this track, I think it's great.
You know, and I think that probably the rest of the Back of the Egg is where Paul McCartney is now, and Baby's Request, like I said, it's the end credits, and that's where he came from. You know, musically, that jazzy feel, it's where he came from. That's kind of like, it takes you all the way back to the beginning, and Back to the Egg. You know, I mean, I just think I discovered the theme of this album after 40 years.
Gah!
Yeah. You know, there was a lot of talk, you know, Juber, for one, we had Juber on the show last year, and we talked about this, you know, the inclusion of you know, would this album not necessarily be better, but would it have sold better with the inclusion of Goodnight Tonight, you know, on the album?
He believes
it would have done 10 times better because of the success. I think it was a top 5 hit. I think Goodnight Tonight was number 5 or 4 or 5 when that came out. You know, what do you think about that? So not really considering it, would it make it a better album, but would have sold better?
I don't think it would have sold better because for the same reason Arrow Threw Me. Because Goodnight Tonight does not represent the album. Goodnight Tonight is its own beast. And now I think that if you're talking in terms of, yeah, we need this record to sell, throw it at the end of side one or throw it at the end of side two, whatever. But that they're going to be breaking up Paul's initial idea for the album.
Right.
You know, the album has a certain feel to it that would totally come in and take away from. And I love that song. And I even think that Daytime, Nighttime Suffering may not fit on this album. I mean, if they put it on, you know, if they, you know, it's just like everyone complaining about, you know, them putting Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields onto Sgt. Pepper.
Right.
Would it make it a better album? Oh, heck yeah. It would just make it the greatest album in friggin' history. But it's also the greatest album in friggin' history without him.
Right.
You know?
Gotcha. Where do you guys put this in the canon? I mean, Steve. I mean, where do you popularity or favorability for you? I mean, where do you throw this in the canon for McCartney?
McCartney. It's my favorite McCartney album. Period, bar none.
Wow.
Yeah.
High praise.
Now, you know, think about. You know, I'm not this. This and McCartney 2 were the last times, I believe, that McCartney made an album that sounded completely different than what came before. I think beginning in 82, he was making albums that all had a similar feel, which I'm not saying negatively. But the experimentation on McCartney 2 was completely different than what was way out there. But there's so much experimentation on this album, but there's so many great songs. Now, look, I'm not saying Getting Closer is better than Jet. I'm saying it's my favorite album. Do I think it's his best album? Yeah, no, but no. You know, I've listened to Band on the Run more than this. I've listened to Red Rose Speedway more. I've listened to McCartney more. But this, I think, is my favorite and deserves people to go and reevaluate it and to give it a listen. Give it a fresh listen because it is a fresh-sounding album. This is an album that does not sound dated. You can listen to London Town and go, oh, that sounds very 1977-78. Back to the Egg, because of the songs, because of Chris Thomas's production, very similar thing with my favorite album of all time, which is Badfinger Wish You Were Here. That album was recorded and released in 1974. You play that for somebody today, they're not going to know when that album was recorded because it's so timeless. Back to the Egg may be influenced by the punk and new wave, but it's not, it doesn't sound like they catered to the audience, and that's what always dates an album. Oh, hey, let's add these keyboards, or this kind of piccolo sound that's really big, or these horns that are really big. And then 3 years later, you're going, "Oh, that's so 1983." this album doesn't suffer from that. It's just fresh from beginning to end.
All right. Yeah. Cool. Andy,
I would rank it. It's definitely in the top 10. Probably the bottom. Probably somewhere between 7 or 8 or 9, but. Definitely top 10. Definitely top 10.
Don't say McCartney 3 is better.
It's not. It's not. It's not even an L. No, it's not better.
I'm kidding.
Listen, after playing the hell out of this record, you know, all weekend, I mean, I can definitely say that it has definitely climbed the ladder, if you will, in you know, the McCartney canon. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not really sure where I put this. I know it's a favorite of mine, so I mean, I know I can definitely will play it often, and I play the whole thing. It's not one of those albums where, you know, I love half of them, the other half of them I'm going to skip. You know, this is definitely a complete album for me, where all the tracks, you know, have something to offer for you, even if you don't like, you know, Rockestra, even if I don't like Rockestra Stream, there's something there about it that still makes it interesting that I want to listen to it, you know, each time I play it. So
yeah, and like I said, it works as an album as a whole, right, from beginning to end. It works together. Everything is there for a reason.
Let's say, and to your point, Sinead, but here's the question. Forget about Goodnight Tonight and Daytime Nighttime Suffering if they were on the album. What if Wonderful Christmas Time was on the album? What does that do to the... How does that change
it? Okay. I mean, it wasn't recorded yet.
It was recorded. It just wasn't released yet. It was already done.
Okay. I'm going to step out on a limb here. I love... Okay, I'm a huge Christmas music fan. A huge Christmas fan. I love that song. I do not understand the hate. I would listen to that song 10 times more than I'd listen to Ding Dong Ding Dong by George Harrison. Or, Christmas songs don't work on non-Christmas albums.
Right.
They just don't.
But crazy period for sure.
It was.
Yeah. I mean, I know that ABBA is going to have a Christmas song on their new album. They stated that. But when you're getting the first album 40 years from ABBA, you can kind of put up with the Christmas. You know, but see, to me, I listen to Christmas music now, and it's September.
it's timeless.
You know, so I still love the song, even though it receives so much hatred, and I'll take a public flogging for that. I love that song. It is so original, unique.
Absolutely. And it's an album. It's a CD. Now, the CD version, the original one that was on EMI pressing, I associate this one.
Yep.
There's the 93. Here's the 93, and here's the 89, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I associate this. To me, it's like a Christmas record because, I got it for Christmas, and when I play it, it's like the whole thing feels very Christmassy to me because it's mm-hmm. it's one of the bonus tracks. It's one of the bonus tracks. So it lends itself to that feel. I mean,
so it was even a bonus track for the 89 release.
It was. Right? Yes, it was.
Okay, cool. Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah, can I?
Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
Can I ask a favor, though?
Sure.
Can we not talk about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reggae?
No, we will.
Done. Done. We're done. Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
So
this one's hard to find. These are hard to find now. You don't see these two.
Yes.
Often.
No, exactly. No, you don't. No. I see the 93s around a lot more than the 89 stuff. But
yeah.
But excellent. Excellent. I love this discussion. What any last thoughts on the record, Steve?
I think it's an amazing record. Like I said earlier, it is really the true spiritual follow-up to Band on the Run. I mean, they start with the same first two letters.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And it's also Band on the Run, Back to the Egg.
Right.
You know,
works.
Hello. Hello. No, I think it's an incredibly overlooked or it's an incredible overlooked album that really, really needs the super deluxe edition or whatever they're, you know, they call
agreed.
Those.
Agreed. 100%.
And I think the only thing probably holding those back is you've got all those contracts of the 50 people that played on Rockestra stuff. And he's probably trying to get clearance for that. That's the only reason I can imagine that has not come out.
That's the word. I mean, I think it was for the concert for the people at Campuchia, which I think is holding,
yeah.
It was just holding it up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I mean, he can release the album anytime he wants. I think he just wants that the Campuchia for a special feature. Mm-hmm. To be included, which would be a great addition,
and of course that Glasgow show, which was professionally recorded, put that in there as well too. I think the album, okay, all the Wings albums, right? I think it's the one that actually does need to be reevaluated the most because it was the last one and it's kind of forgotten. You know, even Wildlife has grown in stature now. Why? Because it's the first Wings album. Okay, so there's a little more history associated with it, and okay, so. Even though it didn't, it was the worst-selling Wings album. It's kind of grown in stature. This one here really needs to be really reappraised and reevaluated because it was the final album and really overlooked by the. It didn't get that same drawing power that Speed of Sound or Venus of Mars or Wings Over America did. And that audience needs to see this now and hear it because the music on this record from start to finish, thematically. It's all here. It's all here on it, and it's going to be an incredible package when it comes out.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that people put Paul McCartney in a box, and I think that's why Wildlife failed because of the fact that he was not being a Beatle. And Paul McCartney has not been, you know, people have to remember the guy who wrote Yesterday. Yeah, it's the same guy that wrote My Love. Yeah, it's the same guy that wrote Getting Closer. But he's not going to keep doing the Beatles over and over again. None of the Beatles kept doing the Beatles over and over again. Unless you count Ringo constantly putting Beatles song titles into his songs. but the thing is people put McCartney in a box. So once they got past the whole Beatle thing, then they started saying, well, this doesn't sound like Band on the Run. Or this doesn't sound like Speed of Sound. This doesn't sound like, you know... But that's the great thing about it is McCartney made a different album every time. Yep, and that's what was a shining.
Yeah. No, I agree with both of what you guys said. I mean, good points by both of you. And it'll absolutely, when we do finally get this box set, I think it's a lot of people who are going to change their tune, you know, about their feelings of this album. And it's deservedly so.
I think this episode of Two Legs needs to be a bonus on the DVD that comes with the box.
Good point. Thank you, Steve. What I also hope we get with this package is Paul today reevaluating this period and giving us his take on what did he think about it. Give us some feedback on the songs. Look at 80-year-old Paul. And let's talk about that period 42 years ago. Now and tell us now what you think about it.
Yeah.
You know, don't just half-ass it. Tell us what you really thought about it, you know?
Right.
We'll have Paul call me and I'll do a Zoom interview with him. Oh, that's right. That's right. You guys are going to fight for me for that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We'll somehow hack your computer, make sure it doesn't work that
no,
day.
No, you guys will get it before I do.
I doubt it. Anyways. But Steve, thank you for being here and talking about Back to the Egg. And let's get back to talking, you know, about you, telling people where they can find you in shows and you know, what it is that you do.
Well, you could find me on YouTube just under the name Stephen Schnee, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, and then the last name, S-C-H-N-E-E. That's where I put all my videos and interviews and, you know, I talk about artists and stuff. Then I also have a few radio shows on Mixcloud. So if you go to Mixcloud and just search my name, or just type in Mixcloud Stephen Schnee, it'll take you to that. You can subscribe there. You can show up on Tuesday nights when I play... this is Ski Lodge Live, and interact with the people. And it's wonderful to create this, you know, just like, you know, what you guys do. It's wonderful to create something to entertain people and to hopefully, you know, give them some kind of joy or something like that. And then to be able to get that back, when, you know, feel that joy when you see people digging the music in the live streams. And they're not saved, so you can't go and see any episode because, you know, the whole copyright thing. You guys know
right.
that.
Yeah, of course,
So, yeah.
Can you take us in real quick? I wanted to ask this earlier, but I forgot. But can you take us kind of into the world of doing liner notes for CDs and stuff? I mean, what's how do you approach that? You know, what has to be in it for you in order to you wanting to do a project like that?
Well, here's an interesting thing. Very few of the projects I've done have been things that I went after. They're usually a label coming to me saying, hey, can you do liner notes? This is serious. Can you do liner notes for an album by Charo and Sal Soul Orchestra? Now, I know that album by the cover because, you know, it's Charo and she was looking hot in 1977 or 1978, especially, you know, wet t-shirt and everything. So I knew it that way, but I never listened to it. So basically a label like that would come to me and they would say, hey, we need somebody to do this. More than likely it was, you know, and of course I don't do anything for free. You know, I mean, as a creative person, you stop doing that, you know, 30 years into your career when you realize it's not getting you anywhere, it's just, you know, get money. So they come to me and they say, let's do this. And, I'll accept it because I love that challenge. I've never listened to that Charo and Sal Soul Orchestra album before, but I go in and I do as much research on it as possible. I have to come up with, and sometimes you try to get a hold of an artist. Of course, couldn't get a hold of Charo. She wouldn't talk about it. And I think it's just because, you know, I mean, Charo's a star. She's not going to talk to, you know, a schmuck like me. But then there are things, you know, and there was I've done probably 20 or 30 different R&B, soul, disco, you know, I did Silver Convention liner notes and BT Express and all these GQ, all these great, you know, soul. But this isn't stuff that I grew up listening to. This is stuff that I enjoy. But I was buying, you know, Beatles, Badfinger, Osmonds, and Glenn Campbell and Neil Diamond and then Queen and then went right into the whole new wave thing. So I was experiencing this for the first time a lot of the times writing about it and researching it. But there were things like Shoes and 2020, things like that I went for, suggested with the label, and I was able to get those. And I had relationships with these people in the band. You know, they knew who I was, so those were easy to get information for. But it is a process. It's a lot of writing, and I never read the liner notes when I'm after I've proofed them, after they're pre-read, they're laid out. I never open that booklet and read my liner notes because I'm going to go, crap, I forgot to mention that.
Say this.
Oh my God, yeah. I put 1873 instead of 1973.
Oh.
You know. So I never go back and read them, but I'm very proud of them and I'm glad that they're out there. But, you know, I did a lot more writing before the pandemic. Since the pandemic, I've sort of switched to the whole video and radio show, because it's more instant gratification. It's more like, I'm done, put it out. Whereas liner note or, you know, writing, sometimes you put it out, it takes a week for it to get posted and stuff. So, you know, I want just to just fill the airways with as much positive energy as possible.
Cool. Excellent. Thank you for that. Yeah. Andy, anything you want to add before we sign off?
Well, thanks. This is great, Steve. Thank you very much. I had a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, it was a complete honor to me, and I was excited when Tom approached me about it and asked me to give $100. That's the only way that you would do it. So hopefully he gave you the 400.
You got to pay us to get on the show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I know it took us a while to coordinate a date to do it, but I'm glad we were able to get a date finally to get her.
I'm so glad, and I had an absolutely 100% great time, and I was able to share my excitement about this record.
Awesome.
Thank you for that. Yeah. So by the time this is up and posted, you'll have we've already done our show series on our favorite non-Beatles related albums, and, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. If you haven't seen that, guys, you know, go ahead to our YouTube channel at Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, and you can check that out. That's going to be a YouTube exclusive. That's the only place where you're going to hear it, because we probably won't put that over here on the audio. So please go to our YouTube channel, check that out, please subscribe, as well as going out and checking out Steve and Schnee's channel, and please subscribe to that as well, because you're getting pretty close to 1,000 subs.
I'm about 135 away or something like that.
Excellent.
So
it's cool.
Getting pretty exciting.
Yeah, she's getting closer. So let's get him there.
Yes. Like and subscribe.
Yes. Right. So everybody out there, go ahead, Steve. Go ahead.
I was going to say thank you, gentlemen, for this opportunity. It was an absolute honor and a pleasure.
Oh, I'm glad we were finally able to get you on the show. Yeah. Really looking forward to this. So you can reach us. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Two Legs Podcast. You can email us at twolegspodcast@gmail.com. We got the website, twolegspodcast.com, where you can find all the Twitter feeds and the shows, the link to the shows there. And I think that covered it. Thank you, everybody, for watching.
You guys have a podcast? Thank you, guys.
This isn't going out. Yeah, this is
yeah, I know.
Chat we're recording. Anyways, thank you, everybody out there in the world of podcasting. We really appreciate you guys being here. And as always, have a great day and a beautiful night, everyone. Take care. We'll see you soon.